Good morning. It's Friday. It's the 67th edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. You folks know the drill already. I'm John. My son and partner here at Zogby Strategies is Jeremy. And we join each other every Friday to discuss a couple of issues in some great depth and detail. And from there, normally we're on different ends of the spectrum, see our world differently, but that's not always the case. Important thing is we picked a topic right as the opening bell opens, and it is really spontaneous on our part, but always respectful. That's our mode. And so, how are you this week?
I'm doing well. I just want to kind of change the language there. You said we're on different ends of the spectrum. You know, I take that as the left, right. I consider myself to actually have exited the left, right spectrum, but you know, that's a different topic.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll have to talk about that.
At
some point. So here are the two topics I came up with, as always, opening bell. So I haven't had time to let these gestate. So the first is a political one. And it starts with Congresswoman Liz Cheney and our neighbor up here in upstate New York, Elise Stefanik. And not only the position of third in line to the leadership of the House Republicans and where that's going, but I guess the whole question of whither the Republican Party, what direction are they going into? Is this consolidating them for 2022 and the future, or is this the beginning of a death knell for the party? So we'll talk about that one. And then the one that I think you might be taking the lead on is the stock market and investments in general. You know, the Dow is at 34,500. And NASDAQ is over 10,000. And we not only have never seen numbers like this, I don't think I ever really dreamed that anybody would see numbers like this. And what's that all about? Where is it heading? So let's talk Liz Cheney. First, I'll just kick that one off. You know, and essentially, there is this internal struggle, not so much between conservatives and conservatives within the party. They're pretty much all conservatives, and Liz Cheney's credentials as a conservative are clear and unmistaken. But her issue is that the Republican Party enables the downfall of democracy by denying the normal change of events that occurs when an election is won by the opposite side. And she believes that, unlike Donald Trump, Republicans have to come to grips with the fact that they lost the presidential election in 2020 and that they need to prepare then for winning elections in 2022. She's been very critical of Donald Trump. He, in turn, has been most critical of her, and we're now at a point where her position within the House leadership is now seriously threatened, to the point where it's probably over. Republicans will vote on her, whether or not she stays in that position next week. Elise Stefanik, elected here in upstate New York, the kind of northeast corner of the state, elected as kind of a moderate Republican in 2014, youngest woman ever elected to the House of Representatives, and someone who has been a rising star and not always a knee-jerk supporter of Donald Trump, but now is using that path, denying the results of the election, voting against impeachment, and grabbing now for herself that number three spot. She's running against Liz Cheney, and by almost every account, will replace Liz Cheney next week. What's going on with the Republican Party? Is this a healthy debate that's taking place? Is this the way to position their future? Remember, voters who identified themselves as Republicans in 2020 voted for Donald Trump 95% to 4% for Joe Biden. Or is this a smart political move by Elise Stefanik and falling on her sword and self-destructing for Liz Cheney? What do you think?
So, I mean, just looking purely at party politics, I mean, who? So Trump had such a huge movement, a successful movement. Who's going to take it over, right? From the rank and file perspective, if anyone goes towards the establishment, you've lost this huge grassroots movement. We've talked about this before. This goes back to Ross Perot. It goes back further than Ross Perot. It's always been in American history, anti-establishment. It probably started off as anti-federalist and Jeffersonian. I'm not going to say that there's a straight line to today, but to the earliest that I can trace it back in terms of, you know, being semi-aware of current events, Ross Perot, the Tea Party movement led by Ron and Rand Paul, which appeared to disappear because it kind of went mainstream and then just fizzled out, but it was dormant. It was latent, but it was still there, ready to come out. And Donald Trump arrived on the scene and got that base really excited. So now he's out, he's gone. Let's assume he's not going to run in 2024. Who's gonna take over this movement? Are you really gonna try and move that that energy away from the anti-establishment sentiment and towards establishment? You probably lose everybody. So you see these people trying to position themselves. I mean, right now I think Ron DeSantis is the one who's trying to position himself for MAGA, and Stefanik is, you know, jumping on board at the state level. So I think, you know, to get to your question, what happens to the Republican Party? You know, you've been talking a while. You've, in different contexts, alluded to the death of the Republican Party. I only see that happening if Democrats get the measure of granting amnesty to millions I guess what would you call them? Migrant workers, right? What's that?
Undocumented
migrant workers, who the Republicans would call illegal, and there's all that, you know, heated debate over that. But that would spell the end of the Republican Party. But if you get these more people like DeSantis and other Republicans, like you mentioned, Stefanik, aligning with that MAGA message, but maybe updating it a little bit, I see more stark division. I see intensification. Right now, I think the entire political landscape is just set up for divide and conquer. I'm not going to say that that's from some, you know, nefarious cabal that's planning this from behind the scenes. I wouldn't go that far, but that's the effect. That's what we're seeing. So forget about the cause. Look at the effect. I see greater intensification. I see more headbutting.
Mm-hmm.
What about you?
Okay. I'm going to build on that, and the death of the Republican Party as we know it. In other words, the Republican Party, you know, we're not going to go back to John C. Fremont and Abe Lincoln. We're just going to go back to what it's represented since the New Deal. And while there have been strong and always growing elements of various flavors of conservatism within the Republican Party, this party now has literally been taken over by MAGA, for want of a better term, the Trump supporters. Very populistic, very conspiratorial, elements of white supremacy and anti-immigration, and so on, to the point where it bothers a lot of folks within the party who used to be called moderate Republicans and mainstream or establishment Republicans. But the bottom line is that what is behind all of this is Donald Trump, former president now, consolidating his control over the party. But taking this sequentially, Republicans are still in good shape going into 2022. Beyond anybody's expectations, the Republicans did not lose seats in 2020. In fact, they gained seats in the Senate and in the House of Representatives, and still benefit by let's call it gerrymandering, but by the districts that were drawn in 2020 because of the census. You now have a situation where if you look at the states that will lose electoral votes, New York, California, Illinois, all of them losing at least one electoral vote, one congressional district, those are blue states, as opposed to those states that are gaining electoral votes. Texas will pick up two. Florida picks up one. States that have gone, North Carolina, will pick up one. So you've got some structural advantages for Republicans, and they've already shown that they can win on a local level with, as a MAGA party. That's why I think you see, this vote in the House, all of these people facing re-election, voting out Liz Cheney next week, the same person that they voted in 2-1 just a few weeks ago after she voted for impeachment. I think you're seeing the formal and maybe final transformation of the GOP into the party of Donald Trump. So you raise a very good question, moving on to 2024. Can the Republicans replicate him if he chooses not to run? That's a good question. And what kind of force is he going to be? If he doesn't run, is he going to pass the torch to somebody else? And if he passes the torch, is that person going to be acceptable? And how hard is Donald Trump going to work for that person? These are all serious complications that I'm going to put on the shelf over here, because meanwhile, we have to talk about the Democrats. And we know that the Democrats had a fairly united message in 2020, but they did not win the electoral vote overwhelmingly in 2020, and they lost congressional seats. What party are they going to be? Are they going to tilt towards progressives? They're going to stay in the center? Too many dynamics here to make our politics predictable. But I'm just going to end my piece of this by suggesting we're probably in a moment right in the eye of the storm where we have a party realignment taking place. And what I see, and I can't help but see, is a floating center here, a floating center that may not like the tilt that President Biden is making towards the left to placate Bernie Sanders, nor can it stomach the more than tilt over to the right that the Republicans are making. And so the issue is, will there be a third party representing moderate Republicans and conservative Democrats and a whole lot of independents who just can't stomach what's going on?
Wow, that's fascinating. Well, our data shows that there's a latent party. Whether you go back to the Intelligencer issue number 9 that talks about the search for common ground, where 90% of Americans agreed with term limits, not only for the House and for the Senate, but also for federal bureaucrats.
Yes.
90%, right? When's the last time we had that kind of common ground? About 90% agree with getting rid of corporate PAC money altogether in campaigns and elections. That's your third party right there. 90 and 90% hold that sentiment in their heart. But to think about the third party going back to the middle, I would just say intense times lead to intense events. And so a return to the middle seems like, to me, that train has already left the station, because we have been, since 2008, marching towards a catharsis intensity that's building and building. And if the last year or two haven't, you know, proven that, then I think we're asleep. So what I'm trying to say is, I think if there is to be a realignment, and it is to take the wind out of the sail of MAGA and Donald Trump and say, no, not within the Republicans, and definitely not within the Democrats, I think that's your third party, anti-establishment, without your face being a part of the establishment, right? Because I always go back to Roger Daltrey and the Who, and I don't think Roger actually wrote that. I think it was Pete Townsend. We won't get fooled again. You know that part in the song, yes. Meet the new boss, same as the old boss. I just see that as the history of the presidency, right? Whether it was, you know, Clinton, Bush, Obama, Donald Trump. Donald Trump was the new boss, but he was the same as the old boss, because even though he touted anti-establishment sentiment, which he convinced a lot of people and maybe even meant, he was of the establishment. So I think that if there is going to be a third party, it has to be the new boss, but it can't be the same as the old boss. And what I find particularly interesting is that, you know, the Democrats have, just like the Republicans and the conservatives who rail about Antifa, and make no mistake about it, Antifa wrought, you know, they wrought havoc over the last year. But there is truth to it that it is exaggerated. But the left does the very same thing with white supremacy, where, you know, I mean, you would think that the Klan would be, I don't know, in the hundreds of thousands. The Southern Poverty Law Center estimates the Klan at about, I don't know, 7,000 membership in the organization. The point that I'm making is, you go back to MAGA, who really started to be attracted to MAGA in 2020? It was Venezuelans in South Florida, Central Americans and other South Americans in places like South Florida. I'm sure it wasn't just South Florida. I'm sure it was parts of Texas, maybe even Southern California. Young Blacks, you know, we were showing in our Newsmax Zogby Strategies poll in October, 36%, I think it was 33 or 36% of the 18 to 24-year-old Black vote were for Donald Trump. So what that means is that signals to me, even though they were favoring the Republican Party, definitely they don't trust the Democrat Party, the you know, these groups I'm talking about. But I think after seeing 2020, I think those are the people that could move towards that third party and say, we don't want to get fooled again.
I think there's a lot of moving parts here. I totally agree with that assessment. And that's what makes this all very dynamic, a very dynamic situation. That's why we talked about it, and that's why we're going to be polling about it as well. So, great. So now I'm going to really pass the torch to you and your interest in economics. These numbers are staggering, and you're talking to a fellow who's got pounded by the stock market and my mutual funds three times since 1987. You know, over the long haul, hey, we did all right. However, at this age, looking at the market at these at way overvalued. Yes, I know we have economic growth. Yes, I know that companies are preparing for the future, but I also know that there are powder kegs out there, Russia, China, instability in the Middle East, the broken record. But the Dow Jones at 34,500, NASDAQ over 10,000. What's going on here? And is this all going to come crashing down?
It has to. It's a fake economy. It's a totally fake economy. You know, I find it staggering that an analyst from Bank of America this past week, and I don't remember her name, but she looked at newsletters coming out from major companies that are integral to the supply chain. And in their newsletters, every single one of them referenced inflation and talked about hiking prices. And so worries about inflation, therefore hiking prices. And so she calculated that year over year, the mere mentioning of the word inflation rose 800%, and then came to the conclusion that that means that there's quote unquote transitory hyperinflation ahead. Now, on the one hand, this is an analyst. Analysts can be wrong. On the other hand, it's Bank of America, one of the top four big banks in the world and in the SWIFT system, talking like that. So, I mean, and I've alluded, you know, last week about that awakening psychology to people really, I think, because I've been observing this the whole decade. And now I feel like you're seeing more and more talk. It's acceptable. People accept it. Prices are rising and they're going to rise. So, you know, I mean, I always go back to another quote. And this is kind of where, you know, that whole left-right paradigm falls apart. You know, on the one hand, right, you go all the way to the left and you have communism. You go all the way to the right and you have fascism. And you step back and objectively look at it. Are they really opposite? Are they really opposing forces? What's the difference between Hitler and Stalin? I mean, other than one was obsessed with class war, the other one was obsessed with race war. But the result was still millions of people jailed and killed and a top-down controlled economy. Essentially, they were totalitarian, centrally planned regimes. So when you look at it in that light, left-right doesn't make so much sense. And so the quote that I go back to is from The Economist, Nobel Prize-winning economist, Friedrich Hayek, who said the curious task of economics is to teach humankind how little we know about what we imagine we can design. And so that ties in because we now live in a system where all of our hope and leap of faith goes to technocrats to plan us and steer us through society. Yet if we look to past examples of technocracy and you know, centralized planning, it fails miserably. And so I think what we're seeing now is the apex of the market. The stock market has gone through the roof because of all the money creation, all of the inflation and the creation of money and QE programs have moved money basically into the Wall Street fat cats and the ancillary industry that go up around it, driving the stock prices higher while Main Street gets poorer. That's a direct result of QE programs. I don't think it was intended. It was an unintended consequence. That's why I quote Hayek, because they imagine they can design a recovery, but they, in effect, have only designed a worse boom, a bigger boom and a much worse bust. So it's just baked in the inevitable failure of this economy, because you see Jerome Powell losing control of the narrative. Janet Yellen too, you know, by my estimation, they're going back and forth. You know, Powell goes on CBS and says, in the long run, the debt's a problem, but in the meantime, not a problem at all. If you step back and really objectively look at that, if you look at that through the lens of a police investigator, you say, he's full of, I can't say the word, but he's full of it. You know, that's double speak right there, classic double speak. So that's what I see going on. I see it looks to be the end of this high. It could probably go on a little bit longer. Who knows how long, but ultimately it has to come down because it's fake and it's synthetic.
So let's end on this note. We've had this conversation before, but in a different context. So now we have throughout the EU and here in the United States, proposals for trillions of dollars to prime the pump of the economy, in Joe Biden's terms, to get the economy rolling again and plan for the future by way of infrastructure, a broad redefinition of what infrastructure is about, including public education and childcare and expanded aid to small businesses and so on. Is that a temporary fix that ultimately leads to a disaster, or is it just disaster not leading to any temporary fix at all?
You know, they say that the apple doesn't fall from the tree. Who's the father of this whole system? It's John Maynard Keynes. You know, when you really dig into John Maynard Keynes' past, you see that he was the head of the British Eugenics Society. That's, I mean, you can go on Galton's webpage, Galton Institute, formerly known as the British Eugenics Society, former vice president or president in the 30s, was John Maynard Keynes, a man obsessed with population control, a man who thought that he could engineer society. This is the system that was born out of his. It's out of whack. I think it's at extreme highs. And I if you just go to those roots, that's disastrous. So I think the fruit that's, you know, born out of that is disaster. It did last. Since 1945, it's propped up economies around the world. But here we are, three generations later, 75 years later, which tends to be about the life of a regime, three generations. And I think the whole thing is just disastrous. It's dead weight. It's got to come down.
Now, this is by no way an excuse. What you say is absolutely true. But by way of context, let's understand that Keynes, other progressives from the progressive movement, not Bernie Sanders progressives, progressive movement of the early 20th century, were representing what essentially was mainstream thought, which is that there was a superior race, there were lesser races, and unfortunately it included folks like Woodrow Wilson and Henry Cabot Lodge, Louis Agassiz, who was the premier academic anthropologist of the day, Margaret Fuller, who among other things founded Planned Parenthood. So we know all of that, and that is one package where they belong. And we need to understand, as you say, the progressive movement within that context as well, eugenics and mongrelization and so on. That was the language until Gunnar Myrdal wrote his famous Race in America tome in the early 1940s, changing the language and changing the debate about race. So we don't want to take Keynes alone.
That's a great distinction.
But with that said, this It was a good discussion. I think maybe we'll leave it right at there, unless you want
to. You're absolutely right. Progressives, I don't mean to make it sound like progressives today are eugenicists. I'm Bernie Sanders and others. No, these are people with big hearts. These are people who genuinely, I believe, care about people. But you're right. It was the movement. But the system we have today is the legacy of that movement. The rank and file progressives are separate from that. But, you know, I talked about Keynes and that's modern macroeconomics. We could talk about, you know, another individual, but we can make that for another time. But no, thank you for making that distinction between the early roots of the movement and today's progressives. But in the end, we still need to recognize the legacy of that system, because that's the system that's running the world right now.
And that's true. And speaking of running, I think we'll get on running and continue running our business. We hope you enjoyed this conversation. Hope you enjoy all of our conversations. Please share what you're seeing, what you're listening to. Spread the word about this podcast. And Jeremy and I will be back next week with God knows what. Have a good week, Jeremy.
You too. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. Bye-bye.